Good evening. My name is Perry Hoffman, and I'm president of the National Education Alliance for Borderline Personality Disorder. I want to welcome all of you to the call for the NEABPD Fall Call-In Series. There are over 200 people on this call, and we're delighted to have such an excellent response to this effort. If you've received the handouts that go along with tonight's lecture, please check your email box. Before I introduce our speaker for the evening, I'd like to orient you to our organization. We're a not-for-profit, 10-year-old organization run by all volunteers. This call-in series is one way we are marking our first decade of work and saluting the many hours of free time given by the professionals to help the BPD community. No one is compensated for their time they give to the organization, including the wonderful professionals who are donating their time to participate on these call-ins. Now for the call and some housekeeping. Everyone is on mute, so there's no background noise during the call. Dr. Frizzetti will talk for about 30, 35 minutes, and then we will throw open the floor for questions. We ask that if you have a question, please send an email to neabpd@com. It's the email address where you got all the information about the call-in. It's now my pleasure to introduce you to Dr. Alan Frizzetti, who is Associate Professor and Director of the Dialectical Behavior Therapy and Research Program in the Department of Psychology at the University of Nevada, where he treats individuals and families. He is also, we're so proud to say, the Director of Research for NEABPD and is the author of The High Conflict Couple and soon to be released, A Family Guide to Borderline Personality Disorder, Finding Peace in Your Family. Over the years, Alan has not only taught many graduate students in psychology, but also has trained well over 100 Family Connections leaders to run our course and share his ideas and strategies to thousands of family members. Alan, as you will see, is an extraordinary teacher both in person and through his writings. It's now my pleasure to turn the podium over to Dr. Alan Frizzetti.
Well, thanks very much, Perry, for that very kind introduction. And welcome to everybody as we kick off this NEABPD series of Sunday night call-ins. I'm actually delighted to do this and hope that this will be useful for you. So as Perry said, I'm going to introduce some ideas and talk through some slides that I hope you all have access to. They're on the NEABPD website, and you should have received them as well by email. If you didn't get them or can't call them up on your computer, I will try to make my words correspond to the slides, but also be as clear as possible. So, and as Perry said, if you have questions, email them to her, and she'll be reading them off so everybody can hear the question, and we'll try to answer as many of them as we can. So first, the title or the topic for today is really communication in our families, and in particular, how to communicate effectively to bring more peaceful, a more peaceful quality to that communication. So, on the one hand, I want to say that communication is not that complicated. We think of it as, you know, someone expresses him or herself, hopefully clearly, and the other person listens and understands. And would it were so simple. So on the first slide, or I guess it's the second one after our title, it's this communication, when it goes well, I call this the communication two-step. It's just like a dance. We go back and forth with one person leading and the other person following. The person who's leading, hopefully, is not too upset. They have low, what we're going to call low emotional arousal. In other words, their level of negative emotion is small to moderate, or if it's large, they're actively managing it. And as you'll see, that's going to be a linchpin in making this successful. So with moderate arousal, the person is quite able to express him or herself accurately. An accurate expression is the first half of this two-step and the first half of what's really the essential of understanding and then being able to act from understanding instead of acting from misunderstanding. So if one person is able to manage their emotion and express him or herself accurately. The other person, if their arousal is also not too high, can listen and really try to understand what the other person is saying and feeling and thinking and wanting, and then that second person can respond in a validating way. Now, validation is of course, a key thing that the listener is going to do. So listening leads to understanding, real, careful attention. An open mind leads to understanding what the other person's experience is. And once we understand it, we can say, okay, this is what I understand, or, oh, that makes sense, or I know why you're feeling this way. It also means that when we're not understanding, we can say that. Say, you know, I don't yet understand. Tell me more. So that I don't understand is not a challenge, like I don't understand you, like you can't be understood, but rather a statement that I really want to understand, but I'm not there yet. Help me. Help me understand. Now, when this goes well, the first person communicates something about what he or she is thinking or feeling or wanting or, you know, something like that, and the other person understands it and can validate. And then, of course, they can take turns. The other person, the second person, can then say something about what he or she is thinking or feeling or wanting, can be responding to the first person, or can actually bring up an entirely different topic. Just depends on the circumstances.
And Alan, I got one email. Could you talk a little louder?
Can I talk louder? Gee, I'm actually talking pretty loud. I'm talking pretty loud. I will try.
Okay,
It could be my phone, but it's... I hope this is better. I'll speak up as much as I can.
Thanks.
Okay. So this is the two-step. One person is expressing accurately. The second person is listening, understanding, and validating back. Now, let's look at the next diagram. This is the key. When things are going well, okay, we start in the middle. Something happens. Okay, so let's say something happens. At work or at home or with a family member or with the other person you're talking to. That's the event. And on the diagram, it's the green box. That's where it starts. So something happens. So let's say that my wife comes home late from work, or one of my kids comes home past their deadline when they're supposed to be home on a Friday night. Let's say that he or she's a teenager, they're supposed to be home at midnight, and they come in late, like it's 12:30 or 1 o'clock in the morning. That's the event. Okay, now if I have low emotion vulnerability, that's the upper left box. If I have low vulnerability to emotion, which is very hard in some circumstances, but if I have it, which means that, well, let's just say, first of all, that I can be in the present situation. I'm not too much affected by all the things that have happened in the past, but I'm mostly responding to what's going on in the moment. I'm not bringing the kitchen sink in from previous arguments. And that's one part of vulnerability. And the other part has to do with just my emotion system biologically. Have I eaten? Have I had enough sleep? Am I taking care of my body? If I've got a cold, am I taking care of it? All those kinds of things. Think about the idea of vulnerability is that if we haven't had much sleep and we're kind of hungry and we have a cold, the same event feels a lot bigger than when we've had a good rest and we're healthy and feel pretty good physically and we've had enough to eat. So the same event is much less in that circumstance. So in a healthy interaction, our vulnerability is low, and the event happens, and then the event affects us. We have an emotional reaction, but hopefully it's a modest one. It's not too big, and that allows us to express ourselves accurately. Okay? So it may be that my wife comes home, and she's late, and dinner's getting cold, and I say, oh, honey, I was worried about you. Come on, let's eat because dinner's getting cold. So I accurately described, so the event is she's late, and I was a little worried about her, and then she can pretty easily validate. I haven't put her on the defensive. I've expressed myself accurately. And then she can say, oh, I'm so sorry, this is what happened. Or even she's not that sorry. Maybe she just got stuck on the bridge and there was terrible traffic. She can say, oh, yes, I'm so frustrated because I was stuck on the bridge and that's why I'm late. Anyway, she can validate the fact that I was worried, say, oh, yeah, of course. Of course you were worried. I'm late and I didn't respond when you phoned myself, and so forth. And then when she validates, then that provides a kind of buffer, if you will. So instead of the next time when something happens, instead of bringing in the kitchen sink, I've got some experience with her listening and responding pretty well in a validating way, and that helps to keep my arousal moderate when something happens. Okay? Now, my teenager comes in late at night. That's harder because, by definition, unless I work the swing shift, it's going to be tough for me because I'm going to be tired at 12:30 in the middle of the night when he or she comes in late. But nevertheless, if I can say, okay, I was worried about you, you're late, it's easier for the child to respond to the worry part instead of other parts. Now, that doesn't mean that there can't be consequences, of course, for the child coming in late and missing his or her curfew. But the best time to handle that, of course, is going to be tomorrow morning, not right now, while my vulnerability is a little bit higher. Okay, so that's a healthy communication when everybody's pretty regulated, everybody manages their emotion, we're not too reactive, and our vulnerability isn't very high. Now, communication misstep, instead of the two-step, happens when one or both people get their emotional arousal up into the danger zone. So when emotion goes up, okay, it gets harder and harder and harder to express ourselves accurately. So let's imagine the situation with my wife coming home late and I've made dinner and dinner's getting cold. So if I allow my arousal to get up pretty high, if I allow myself to focus on things like, oh, she's been late, she's done this before, or I get judgmental in my mind and I think, oh, she's so insensitive, or things like that, then my arousal goes up. And I get, instead of just being worried and then able to be happy to see her, when she finally comes in the door, I say something like, where in the world have you been? And I say it maybe a little meaner than I just did just now. Instead of, honey, oh, I'm so glad to see you, I was worried about you, I come up with, where in the world have you been? Dinner's cold. You've ruined dinner. And so it's really hard for her at that point to validate because I haven't told her that I was worried. I'm just criticizing her. I'm just giving her a hard time. It's very hard for her to come back and say, oh, sweetie, I love you too. I'm sorry to worry you. It's hard to say that when somebody's attacking you. Or it could start the misstep could be the first person expresses him or herself reasonably accurately, but the other person responds with a lot of emotion, which I think we sometimes call defensiveness in the ordinary language. But I think defensiveness means that the person is feeling emotion that's not just from this present situation. Now, sometimes defensiveness comes because a person is attacking, and then defensiveness makes sense. We all want to defend ourselves when someone's attacking us. However, sometimes defensiveness pops up and nobody's attacking us. And if that happens, that's because the person is bringing some emotion with them from a different situation. Maybe their arousal is just high from their vulnerability or from previous interactions just like this one. And so they're kind of sensitive to the situation. So even if I say, oh, honey, I'm so glad to see you. I was worried about you. Because dinner's getting cold, even if I say that, maybe she's had a bad day. Maybe she's really tired. We know she's hungry because she's late for dinner. Maybe she's remembering an argument we had just about a situation like this just a few weeks ago when I wasn't managing myself as well. And so maybe she reacts in a more invalidating way, like it's no big deal that I'm a few minutes late, for crying out loud. You're late sometimes too. Now, that kind of response, of course, has an impact on me, then my arousal goes up, and my ability to express myself accurately goes right down the toilet. So this two-step can become a two-misstep very easily with either person. When either person stops managing their emotion, the whole thing changes course, and instead of being a situation of communication and understanding and being able to respond to each other and nurture each other and take care of each other, it's a situation of criticism and attack and misunderstanding and even something that might sound more like contempt. It's much, much more painful. Now, in the next diagram, which is a little bit more complicated, you see this is what happens in this second example where there's problematic communication. You can have the same event, okay? And in that purple arrow going from the event to arousal is still there. But now you'll notice to the left, there's high emotion vulnerability. The person is tired, hungry, or is thinking about previous circumstances that haven't gone well, or is anticipating something not going well, or is doing other things that actually bring negative things from the past into the present situation. That could be a source of arousal that adds to whatever arousal comes out of the event itself. Now, just below the event, you'll see a new box that says judgments with little red arrows. And one arrow goes from the event to the judgment. Sometimes we get judgmental about the event. Maybe when my wife comes home late, maybe I get judgmental. I say, she's being a jerk. She's being insensitive. She should do this differently. Those are judgments. And the thing about judgments is that judgments always jack up our emotions. They always do. There's no way around it. If we're judgmental of another person, it takes our arousal and turns it into anger and turns it up one or more notches. Now, notice that the next arrow below judgments goes back and forth. It's not only that judgments can create more arousal, but also, more arousal can actually get us to be judgmental. If we get upset enough, when we get upset enough, we start to think in very black and white terms, right and wrong, on and off, should and shouldn't. And those kinds of terms, we typically think of them as judgmental. And so high arousal can actually lead us to be judgmental, which, of course, just perpetuates the arousal. Now, the trouble is that when our arousal goes up high enough, that's that little asterisk there, heightened emotional arousal, if it gets big enough, our ability to express ourselves accurately fails. We can't be accurate any longer. We just say the most inaccurate things. We criticize. We bring in things from long ago. Instead of saying, gee, honey, I'm so glad to see you, which was true, and I was worried about you, which was true, now I'm saying she's a jerk for being late, which is a pure judgment. And, of course, if you remember, if I'm glad to see her and was looking forward to seeing her, telling her she's a jerk and insensitive and shouldn't have come home late is not actually going to get me what I want in this situation. And it's going to get her much more easily to be invalidating. Like, why are you attacking me? You know, why would I even want to come home to this? And then we have more garbage in our history. We've got more stuff to remember the next time we're in a tough spot, which makes it harder and harder to slow down and bring our arousal down before we open our mouths. All right, so let's think about some solutions to this. Let's think about the solutions as having two parts. There's one part if we're the person who's trying to express ourselves, and another part if we're the person whose role, at least at this moment, is to listen to the other person. Okay? So if it's our turn to express ourselves, the first step needs to be managing our own emotion. Now, this sounds like it should be easy, but I'm guessing that out of the 200 people on this phone call, that there isn't anybody who's never said something mean to someone that we love. I'm assuming that we've all done that, and that's a moment of dysregulation when we love the person, which means that we want to have a good relationship, and yet we find ourselves saying something that's mean. That's not helpful to that relationship and maybe not even very nice to the other person. And that's a dysregulated moment. And to do that, we have to, at that moment, forget the nature of our relationship. We have to forget what our real important goals are. And we have to forget that we love the other person. And only when we do all three of those things can we then be mean, okay? So if we can remember, wait a minute, what did I want here? Oh, yeah, I wanted to have a nice evening with this person. Or what did I want? Oh, I wanted to find this piece of information out from the other person. Or whatever it might be. Our goals can keep us focused and keep our arousal at a moderate level where we can manage it and express ourselves accurately. And, of course, if we remember that the other person we're talking to is somebody that we love deeply, that can keep us from criticizing and being ineffective in our communication. It can get us to be soft and gentle and say things very descriptively. That'll be next. So we have to let go of our judgments. We have to let go of the shoulds in our mind, like you shouldn't have come home late, or you shouldn't do this, or you shouldn't do that, or if the person didn't do something that we want them to do, you should have done this. Okay? The facts are I wanted her to come home on time, and she didn't. The facts are I wanted my son or daughter to come home on time, and he or she didn't do it. And that right now, he or she is home and safe. Now, maybe he or she, maybe they've been using drugs. Maybe they've been drinking. Maybe they were out with somebody that they weren't supposed to be out with. Those are huge problems, and I don't want to minimize those, but it's also the case that at this moment, the person is safe. And so in terms of that goal, okay, that's satisfied. Okay, that doesn't mean it was satisfied well. It doesn't mean it's a good situation, but now we have to think about when's the best time to express ourselves. So if we remember our goals, remember our relationship, let go of our judgments, and soothe ourselves a little bit and say, okay, this is a tough situation. My teenager came home an hour late. I can smell alcohol. I don't know, maybe he or she was driving, maybe he or she wasn't driving, but I'm worried. I'm really worried. But if it's the middle of the night and I'm not at my best and he or she's not at his or her best, the morning is the time to do this, so what I'm going to do is describe accurately what's going on. And then I can do it again in the morning. It'll be easier in the morning because I'll have slept and ate and had a chance for all this to settle down a little bit. Now, that leads us to accurate description, to be able to describe what it is we're trying to do accurately. Are we trying to say, do I want you to know what I'm thinking? Do I want you to know what I'm feeling? Do I want you to do something differently? What do I want? Okay, that's my goal. So if I'm going to describe it accurately, I'm not going to be interpreting you. I'm not going to be judging you like you should have already done this or you should have already known this. And I'm not going to be judging myself like this shouldn't bother me or I shouldn't be upset. All right, the facts are I am upset. I'm worried or I'm scared. Okay, that you came home so late. And without any interpretations, I don't know what happened yet because I haven't asked and you haven't told me. But I do know that I'm upset and I know that I'm scared and I know you're late. Those are facts. So if I stick with the facts and maintain my self-respect, I can be honest with you. I'm scared. Okay, but be effective. Without any judgments, that self-respect is going to not be so much a criticism of the other person, but a description of my disappointment or my sadness or my fears, almost certainly one of those. I also have to be careful to keep clear, what am I trying to express? Something that I'm thinking, like a thought that I'm having, an opinion, a worry, because things about the future are only thoughts, they haven't happened. They could be emotions I'm having right now about those thoughts, but they're still, the thoughts haven't happened. Or they're emotions I'm having in the moment, my feelings right now. Or it could be something I want, something I want to be different, something I want you to do, something I want, something I desire. And to be clear about what is it I'm trying to do here? Am I trying to tell you what I'm thinking, what I'm feeling, or what I'm wanting? And keep those goals in mind. What are my goals? Oh, yes. Maintain my relationship with you. I love you. And, oh, yeah, the other goal. I want to communicate that I'm upset. I'm scared because you're so late and I think you've been drinking. And I'm worried about that. So in the morning, we need to figure out how to make this situation safer, okay, and how to get you home on time without having been drinking, assuming that we're talking about, you know, a 15-year-old. Okay, now all those kinds of things, it doesn't mean that the two-step is going to work. It means that our part of the two-step is going to be good, and it's going to be effective. And that even if the other person doesn't respond well, we've maintained our self-respect and kept the channels of communication open. Okay? So that's the solution for our expressive part. Now, when it's our turn to listen, of course, the first part of this is quite similar, right? We have to remember our goals. Right this moment, I want, if you're talking, okay, it's your turn to talk, then I really do want to listen. I really want to understand what you have to say, what your experience is. You know, if you're my wife and you come home late and dinner's cold, I want to understand what happened. Maybe you've had a bad day, or maybe you didn't. Maybe you forgot. I don't know. If you're my teenager and you've come home in the middle of the night later than you're supposed to, and I think you've been drinking, then let's assume now it's the next day. I want to understand how you ended up in this situation. Really understand. I don't like it. I'm not going to pretend I like it. I don't like it. I'm going to be clear about that. I'm going to be clear what my expectations are, but not because my teenager is a bad kid, not because they've done anything that's wrong in the judgmental sense. It's wrong in terms of breaking a rule. It's dangerous, but that doesn't make the person bad. So we're going to try to keep the judgments at bay, let go of the shoulds, keep an open mind and open ears. Like, what is the reality? What drove my teenager to do this? I don't like it. It scares me. I want to understand it, because if I can understand it, I may be able to be more effective at helping him or her change it. It may be different in the future. Now, listening, of course, requires, first of all, I have to manage my emotion. And then the second step is I've got to validate. In order to validate, though, I have to understand. I have to understand the other person's experience in order to validate what's valid about it. Now, of course, we only validate what's valid. We don't validate things that aren't valid. So if my teenager says, you know, what happened was that, you know, I knew that I was supposed to be home by midnight, but the person who was supposed to give me a ride was drinking, and I didn't want to get in the car with that person, and I knew that you didn't want to, and I thought maybe you were asleep, but I didn't want to wake you up, and so I waited for a different friend to give me a ride home who wasn't drinking. And that took 45 minutes. I knew that, you know, I took a chance because I knew if you were awake, you'd be worried, and I feel bad about that. But I also thought if you were asleep, then this wouldn't be a problem. All right, now I'm not saying that's always the answer. Sometimes it's not nearly as nice as that. But then if I listen with an open mind and an open heart, I can understand. Okay, so your intentions were not to do X, Y, or Z. Okay? What was your experience? And I can legitimize the other person's experience when I understand it. But I can legitimize it, not really, until I truly understand it. So you really were trying to get home on time. Wow, if I could really understand that, then that soothes me. I don't feel like it was personal. I don't feel like you were, you know, being, you know, insensitive to me if you're my wife. If you're my child, then you really were trying to be responsible. You really were trying to do what we agreed you'd do. Okay, that's different. That makes me feel better. That doesn't mean there might not be a consequence. That's a different question. But it's nice to know what's going on. And maybe I don't like the answer I get, but now I understand it and I can help us figure it out. Now, this validation thing is terribly important. We've done a number of studies showing that when we validate somebody, when we really validate, we really get the other person's experience and say, aha, now, that makes sense, and this is how it makes sense. So we really get it, and we communicate that it makes sense. It's legitimate for that person to have that experience there, what they're thinking, what they're wanting, what they're feeling, that it actually soothes the other person's emotional arousal. And so if the person we're talking about has borderline personality disorder, and they have a lot of just out of control emotions, then feeling understood and being validated is one way to actually be very helpful to that person. It may take a very long time. It may not happen, not very much may happen the first 25 or 50 times we do it, but sooner or later that validation squeaks through. And that soothing that comes with validation can make an enormous difference. Now, the good news is that validation is not that complicated to describe. We're simply saying what we understand about the other person's experience. And so if the other person is really upset with me, like yelling at me, I can validate that. Well, what's valid? Well, gee, you're really upset with me. I can tell. You see, I can see. You're really mad at me, but I don't know why. Or just like, wow, you're really upset with me. Could you tell me what that's about? Okay, so that willingness to listen, to understand, and saying, okay, I get it so far, that can help the person get organized and become part of the two-step. That person can then become more accurate in his or her expression. And, of course, when they're accurate, they're not criticizing us. They're not being contemptuous of us. They're not judging us, which is a whole lot nicer for us. And, of course, then if we're able to validate them, that makes it easier for them to be accurate in their expression, which gets the whole thing moving differently. So validation doesn't mean we have to like what the other person's experience is, but we have to try to understand it and communicate the legitimacy of it as part of that person's experience. You know, so, you know, my teenager might want me to buy him or her a new car. Well, you know, what teenager doesn't want their parent to buy them a new car? Okay, that makes sense. I mean, okay, but just because it makes sense that they want it doesn't mean I have to do it. But it's really helpful to say, yeah, of course I understand why you want me to buy the car. I've got more money than you do. And it would be great. It would be so much nicer for you if somebody just bought it for you. That's all true. Then the person gets it. Okay, you get that this is hard for them. They can't, you know, it's hard for a 16-year-old to earn enough money to buy their own car. That's hard. Doesn't mean we have to buy it for them. It just means that we understand that it's a struggle. And that can make them feel understood and be a lot less demanding. Okay, now I've gone for my part here, half an hour, the overview, the nuts and bolts of this. And so what I'd like to do now is field some questions. Perry, I hope somebody's written in some questions.
Yes,
and,
we do have some questions.
Try to put some flesh on the bones of this.
Okay, let's see. Well, let's start with, can you repeat the reasons again about thinking about previous circumstances that haven't gone well?
The reasons to not focus on that?
And the question just says, can Alan repeat reasons again, quote, thinking about previous circumstances that haven't gone well?
Well, I assume that the question means why it wouldn't be effective to be dwelling on that. I think there are two reasons why it's not effective. One is that it just kicks our arousal up. Our previous experiences, if they didn't go well, resulted in us being disappointed or hurt or worse, maybe angry. Or maybe we did things that we're not proud of. Maybe we feel embarrassed about it. The fact is, if they're in the past and we bring that emotion from the past into the present, all that does is make our emotion in the present go up more, which makes it harder to act effectively right this minute. So that's the main reason. I mean, I guess the second reason has to do with just in the accuracy of the communication, the other person is going to feel very defensive if we bring up things from the past. So it's going to make their arousal go up too. And if we don't tell them why we're upset the way we are because we've been thinking about the past, then we're not expressing ourselves accurately. So it sets the whole thing off in the wrong direction. I hope that I'm answering the right question here.
Okay, well, I think you are. How can I possibly validate my daughter when she lies to me?
Oh, that's such a great question. Well, of course, the lying, we have to think, well, in what circumstances would somebody lie? And it turns out that social psychologists study this a lot, and it turns out that just about everybody lies sometimes. And you know, it's good to think that, I mean, we like to think that, gee, well, we don't do that or we don't do it very often. But in fact, people lie for exactly the same reasons, whether they're big or little. Now, I'm not trying to minimize your child's lying, okay, because that's a problem. But we have to think, okay, well, why would somebody lie? Well, because, one, telling the truth, they perceive that telling the truth is actually going to receive a much more punitive or unpleasant response, and the person is trying to avoid that. I'm not saying that's a great thing. I'm saying that's just the real realities of life. People do that. People perceive, gee, if I'm going to get yelled at for this, then maybe I'll not tell you about this. And so a lie could be an error of omission. I just don't tell you something. Or an error of commission. I actually misstate the facts. So that's one possibility, and that's probably the most common reason why people lie. Now, so let's think. So what could we validate about that? Well, that really means a couple of things. One, it means that they're caring about our response, okay? And that they were probably pretty anxious or fearful about their consequences. Now, the consequences could be what we're going to do, or it could be consequences for themselves. Like, they're so embarrassed about it that that's the consequence that they're trying to avoid. Maybe we as parents are going to say, gosh, you know, I'm really disappointed, but, you know, there's nothing big or punitive about that. But maybe they feel so terribly ashamed that they can barely bear it. Some of our family members, especially people with borderline kinds of problems, are exquisitely sensitive to other people's reactions. And other people's reactions, being disappointed, can actually elicit a lot of shame in them. And shame is very, very painful. And many of our family members, many of our loved ones with BPD, carry around a lot of shame. And so trying to not feel that overwhelming sense of shame, strangely, paradoxically even, can lead them to do something like lying. Now, I'm not condoning it. I think it's a big problem. But in terms of how do you validate it, well, we have to sit down and say, okay, I'm trying to understand how it was that you didn't tell me the truth. How it was that you weren't accurate about this. By the way, lying is just one way of being inaccurate. It's a big way, but it's just one way of being inaccurate in our expression. And so if you could sit down with your daughter, and not at that moment, but at a different moment, and say, you know what, honey, I really want to understand how you got there, because I know that, you know, you probably don't take this lightly, and yet you ended up doing something that I know you don't feel good about, and I don't feel good about. So let's look at how you got there. And then, really, that's the time then to listen with the open heart, to see what it is. And then whatever that is, I think is something we can validate. We don't validate the lying, except that it's valid to avoid whatever she's avoiding. It's valid in that sense. In the same way that drinking is valid, it's a way to feel numb. It's not a very effective strategy for coping, but it certainly works to feel young, to feel numb, in the same way that self-harm can actually work for many people to bring their really unpleasant, terrible, high negative emotion down. Now, it's valid in that one small way. It doesn't mean we support it. It just means it makes sense. We can understand it. I hope that gives you some sense of what I mean by valid. I'm not sure the lying itself is valid in more than a very small way, but the reasons for it probably do make sense.
Okay, great.
Even if we don't like them.
Here's another one, Alan. People with BPD who also experience chronic depression, communication is doubly difficult. Difficult to engage as they're often overly detached and avoid dialogue. Is there a way to use these skills to encourage communication overall, elicit feelings, etc.?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, when people are really depressed, we know that it's not only is it hard for that person, but it's hard for the people who love people who are very depressed. Because the reactivity, when you mix depression and borderline personality disorder, the reactivity is often that the person kind of implodes. They feel worse about themselves. And of course, if we care about them, we don't want them to feel worse about themselves. So using these skills, the idea would be how to try to engage the other person in a conversation and to see which role they want to take. Are they willing to tell us a little bit about their day to start them, just to kind of get them primed? Like, what are you feeling right now? How was your shower? You know, or, you know, how did such and such a thing go? and then really listen and validate. And the idea is that with a depressed person, sometimes depressed people, it's a little bit like they're wearing a rubber suit. And so when we validate or when we do things, it kind of bounces off them. It's like they don't really absorb it. They don't really get the love and the care that we're intending. So we might have to do it many, many times before we find a seam in that rubber suit. But when it lands, when it finally lands, the person can feel, oh, I'm not alone here. You get it. You get it. And then they can peel back some of that rubber suit and open up the channel of communication. The good news is this two-step works in both directions. So if the other person's willing to say even a little, and we can validate a lot, that will help them to say more, to express more. Similarly, maybe they are interested, maybe they could be interested in us telling them a little something about our day, and they could listen to that and respond to that a little bit, and then we can, of course, validate them for their listening and their care. So any little seam that's open is worth exploiting, and on either side, either on the expression side or on the validation side. It takes an enormous amount of resilience to do this, because when people get very depressed, their responses can be very, very small. So we have to keep at it, sometimes for a very long time. And, of course, part of that is getting support from other people to keep doing it, because it may be a while before the other person is very responsive, before we really have a sense, gee, this really is making a difference. I'm really getting through. The person knows I'm trying. It may take some time before we get that kind of feedback.
Okay, here's a different one. When my daughter behaves inappropriately and explains the reason for her behavior to her therapist, the therapist always validates her. This is good, but my daughter sees the validation as permission for inappropriate behavior. This happens even when she is told that her behavior was wrong. She seems to tune that part out, only hearing the validation, which she interprets as justification for her behavior.
Huh, that's very interesting. You know, of course, I have no idea what her therapist is actually saying or doing, and her report of what the therapist is doing may or may not be accurate. But certainly, this is tricky. As a therapist, and of course, my disclaimer here is that, you know, I run a DBT treatment program, and so that's the kind of therapy that I do. But certainly, in dialectical behavior therapy, when we validate the valid things, you know. So let's say that the previous woman who wrote in it was about lying. And so let's say that a patient told me about lying. I might do the exploration of what got the person to lie and validate the feelings behind it. But as a therapist, I would not stop there. I would say, okay, and now how are you going to handle those feelings next time differently so you don't lie? So the treatment target becomes oftentimes for patients, they polarize. It feels like, okay, if I do the effective thing, I have to feel terrible, so I'm going to not do the effective thing so I don't feel terrible. So I'm going to hurt myself so that I can get some relief, or I'm going to lie so I don't feel ashamed or so I don't get yelled at. And so, of course, in therapy, at least in DBT, the solution is to find a way to be honest or to not harm or whatever, but at the same time not to feel so terrible. So to teach the person how to manage his or her emotions and be more effective. So I'm guessing that for this question, this person with the question, it's very hard to know, because it could be that the therapist is only validating the valid and not doing some real pushing to on the other part, not blocking the dysfunctional parts and trying to really problem solve the change. It may be that the therapist is just validating the valid parts and ignoring the others. That's possible, in which case it would make sense that your child would only get that message. I have no idea. Or it's possible the therapist is doing both parts and the child is struggling and having a hard time and feels so embarrassed that the child sort of says, gee, you know, my therapist at least understands me and you don't. It's a kind of way to push us away. It's very hard to know, but I would recommend that you try to get a session, a family session with a therapist, and try to get out on the table exactly this issue. So if the child's doing something like lying or stealing or drug use or something that's problematic, it would certainly be, I suspect, very helpful for you to hear that the therapist is on top of that, not just understanding the reasons why your child would do those things and validating the experience, but also saying, okay, now how are we going to get you to change that so that you aren't stealing or aren't lying or aren't harming yourself or whatever it might be. I realize it's not probably a very satisfying answer. It's hard without knowing, without being a fly on the wall, to hear what the therapist said.
Yeah, to know what the one's perception versus the other's perception.
Yeah, exactly.
My BPD loved one can't tolerate back and forth conversation, but regularly starts and ends communication by yelling, blaming, criticizing, and slamming doors. There is no opportunity to talk about any upset, not in the moment, not the next day, not at all. What are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are poor you. I mean, that sounds awful. This just sounds overwhelmingly terrible and very demoralizing. That very sincerely. It's like when you've tried just by your list, it seems like you've probably tried a lot of different things at a lot of different times, and your loved one is not responding, and that's just very demoralizing. I guess, you know, this isn't much, but what I would suggest is to try to build a bit of a communication bridge by picking up some things to talk about that aren't the slightest bit contentious, that aren't even a little bit in the area of the couldn't possibly be described experienced as critical or putting demands on your loved one. So something about something that interests your loved one that you noticed in the newspaper or that you know about, and just try to ask him or her about just some pretty innocuous things, very quick, two steps, like, tell me about this, and then you listen and smile and say, oh, that's nice, or oh, I'm sorry to hear that, and then let it go. You know, give yourself like 20 seconds and then stop and move on so that he or she can have a lot of experiences of your caring and your listening and your attention where it's very hard to feel criticized, you know, by bringing up, you know, it sounds like this person is highly reactive to situations where there are difficulties, and bringing up a difficulty of any kind, this other person feels defensive. And so you've got to have a strong bridge of communication that's not about those things, that's so clearly not about those things, before at any point then saying, gee, it seems like you were upset about something. And I would encourage you to try to be in the listening role for a while, as opposed to in the expressing role for a while, and see if you can't build some of that bridge out for a while. But it's very, very, sounds very demoralizing. And so also I would say, of course, you need some support to do this too.
Alan, can you give three examples of a validating statements?
Sure. Validating statements. So let's think about, the person. I assume that the question is around when it's a difficult situation. So, your teenager is yelling at you. What could you say that would be a validating statement? You could say, "Wow, you know, you're really mad at me, aren't you?" But not in a sarcastic way, but like, "Wow, I get it," or even to say, you know, I know, I can tell you're really upset with me. I think that could be just a beginning, a little bit of validating. So that's one way, is to say, to start out a statement with I know that, or I can see that, or gee, you look sad, or you look upset, or you look tired. Just those things themselves can be validating.
All right, I'm going to throw a question in that a lot of people are wondering how you validate this. My daughter was diagnosed with BPD but refuses to see a therapist. How do I validate that?
Well, I'm not sure you validate that. I mean, what's valid about that? I think the only thing you could validate is, okay, so I know that right now you don't want to do that. I don't know why you don't want to. Is it you're feeling, I want to understand it. Are you feeling hopeless? Are you feeling scared? Do you just not have enough energy? What is? Do you think that things aren't really very big problems? I think we have to understand something about the person's experience before we can validate anything. All we know right now is the person won't go to therapy, so all we can really say is, okay, I know you don't want to go. I know you don't want to go is all we know, so that's all we can validate. But we can draw out the rest of it. Like, I want to understand. I'm not trying to pick a fight. I'm not going to criticize, but well, how come? How come you don't want to? It seems like you're unhappy a lot, and I want to understand why you're so reluctant to go to a therapist.
Okay,
then you
one
might
more validating
more expression that you can validate. I'm sorry?
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So I say, and then if you draw something out, then there might be something of the person's experience that you can validate.
Okay, terrific. And did you have one more validating example you wanted to give us?
Yeah, I mean, there are many. I think that that another one is to say, is to start out your response by saying what makes sense to you. Like, it makes sense to me that blank, that you think this or that you feel that. You know, it makes sense to me that you feel scared to have this conversation because we haven't had a lot of successful conversations about this topic. You know, of course you feel that way. Of course. Anybody would feel that way. Those are all ways to start to be validating. But, of course, the idea is it has to really make sense. The of course has to be true. It's like, you know, if I had to work a double shift because people called in sick and I came home and said I'm tired, you'd say, of course you're tired. You know, that would be very validating. It would be more validating than say, well, tell me why you're tired. You know, well, gosh, isn't it obvious? You say, of course you're tired. So those are all relatively straightforward and often very helpful ways to start on a validating statement.
Okay, here's another one that's similar to that. During times when my 17-year-old daughter is insulting me or making threats, my immediate response has been to end the conversation and walk away. Is it better to validate? I worry about giving attention to this kind of behavior.
Yeah, you know, your question actually is very nice because you're highlighting the two sides of this very, very well. Because you're the person, your teenage daughter is being critical of you and being insulting. And, of course, you know, I think as parents, you know, there are moments when we have to tolerate little bits of that, but, you know, I don't think that's fun, and it's often not all that helpful. So I think the idea is you're worried, you want to just sort of end the conversation, which makes a lot of sense, and at the same time, because you don't want to pay attention to it, meaning you don't want it to work. You don't want to give her a lot of warmth and love when she's being really kind of crappy to you, and that makes perfect sense. But I think what you can say is, you know, honey, I know you're upset with me right now. You know, like, that's the validating part. I know you're upset with me right now, or I know you're really upset right now, but, you know, it's not okay to talk to me that way. So I'm going to take a break, and I want to come back and hear more. If you want to talk about it, I want to hear more, but without the insults. And so I think that, I hope that from that example you'd say, gee, that's not paying a lot of attention, not positive attention to it. But it's certainly not abandoning your teenager. You know, if she really has problems with BPD, she's probably very sensitive to abandonment. And so just turning around and walking away could actually be very, very provocative. Whereas saying, honey, you know you're upset and I really want to understand and I really want to help, but it's not okay to insult me. So I'm going to take a break now, and I'd be happy to talk to you later in 10 minutes, but without the insult. And so it's very clear you're not abandoning, and it's also very clear that you're not going to tolerate being insulted, but you're not tolerating it. It isn't going to result in you being punitive and contemptuous and nasty. You're just not going to do it. You're not going to do that dance. So I hope that gives you a way out of that one. That's a tough one that I think every parent experiences sometimes, because teenagers, you know, lots of teenagers get to that spot. It's really awful, and I appreciate your seeing both sides of it.
Okay, and how does one motivate another person to do a relatively small thing for their own great benefit when they haven't done it for months? How does one validate that behavior?
Well, I think the question here, you're trying to say, how do you validate something that's not valid?
Mm-hmm.
It's the not doing the thing that's effective isn't valid. The reasons for not doing it might be valid. Okay, so let's take somebody who does something like overdoses. Okay, there's only one very, very small way that that's a valid behavior. It's valid in the sense that the person was trying to escape, and overdosing allowed that person to escape emotionally, knock themselves out, get numb, whatever it was. So it's valid in a very small way. That's not the part I think that we need to validate. The part we need to validate is to say, I want to understand what you were escaping from. What was feeling so terrible? What was so awful? I want to understand that. That's the part we can validate when we understand the feelings, the emotions, what the person's got in their life that they don't want, or what they don't have that they do want. And so if the person's not doing things that would be very effective, I'm not sure there's much to validate about that other than, gee, tell me, you know, you haven't, you know, let's say it's, you know, gone out with friends. You haven't gone out with friends in a while, and I'm wondering, well, why not? What's getting in the way? How come you haven't gone, you know, out with your friends? And then when you listen to that, then you can validate that. Gee, you know, the person doesn't have the energy or really feels left out of that group of people. They have, you know, feels down on him or herself. I don't know. Who knows what it will be? But when we hear those things are things we can validate, not the invalid parts, not the ineffective behaviors. They're only valid in very small ways.
Okay, terrific. We have just a few more questions, and before we do that, I just want to put in a little insert that I meant to say when we started. For those of you who are on the call and you find it helpful and would like us to continue to do these calls, not only this 10-part series but other series, we'd greatly appreciate it if you would make a donation to the organization. If 200 people are on this call and every person made a donation, it would be amazing. So I just want to ask all of you to think about that. We're all nonprofit, all volunteers, and want to continue to do our work and hope that you appreciate and can help us do that. Okay, so here's another question. What resources, books, websites, et cetera, do you recommend for learning more about skills to effectively communicate with a relative with BPD?
Well, that's a great question. I think that, you know, the website, the NEA BPD website, is one place to start. There's lots of resources there. I think that the bpdfamily.com website often has a lot of good things on it. I don't mean to exclude anybody, but I honestly don't surf that much, but I think these are good places to start. You know, NEA BPD has a lot of materials on the website. There are videos that you can watch. Certainly the Family Connections Program is all about learning skills for parents and partners and other people who have loved ones with BPD. And the Family Connections Program, like everything else we do at NEA BPD, is also free. So I'm not trying to generate income either, just like Perry. But the organization does of course need money to run. You know, the website's expensive to maintain and all those kinds of things. But those would be good places to start. In terms of books, you know, there are now some books out there that are pretty good. For such a long time, there were so few. You know, Perry and John Gunderson have edited a book. Perry, I think it's called, what's it called? What's the name of the book?
Understanding and Treating Borderline Personality Disorder.
Yeah, Understanding and Treating BPD. There's a nice book. I'm not going to remember the names of these off the top of my head accurately. There's a nice book by Alec Chapman and Kim Gratz. It's got borderline personality disorder families in the title, something like that. There's a book by Shari Manning about loving somebody with BPD, which I think is pretty good. And then, of course, I'm partial to my own books too, but, you know, I think these are all pretty good resources.
Okay, terrific. Alan, I think we've come to a close. This has just been outstanding and so appreciated by the organization, and I'm sure by people on the call as well. The last question I'll just put out to you, because people always ask this in terms of family connections: how much of the work that you do is about DBT, and where does it all fit in?
How much of the family work?
Yes.
Well, you know, dialectical behavior therapy is a pretty comprehensive model, provides a pretty comprehensive model. And I was lucky enough to bump into the model, when I bumped into Marshall Linehan when I was a doctoral student a long, long time ago, back in the 80s. And, you know, lots of us have run with that model and find it to be very helpful. So the model itself is useful, and then, of course, a lot of the skills in DBT are useful. I think if we see borderline personality disorder as fundamentally a problem of emotion dysregulation, which is related to impulsivity and out-of-control behavior and cognitive dysregulation and so forth, then a lot of the things that we put together with for families are based on the same model and include many of the same skills. So it's a nice umbrella for all of these kinds of things.
Okay, terrific. We this call-in series is, this is the first of 10. We have the most Sunday evenings except for next weekend, the weekend of November 4th and 5th, because we'll be in Atlanta, and we hope those of you who are interested in coming will come to this wonderful, outstanding conference that we have Friday, November 4th. So that weekend we won't have our call-in, and then we also won't have it the weekend of Thanksgiving. Those of you who have signed up for the 10 series, please use your same number. Those of you who would like to be added on, please let me know, and we'll send you numbers as well again. I want to thank Alan again. I want to thank everybody for joining us, and we would love to get feedback on from you using the same email address about how the call went, what you'd like us to do differently, what you'd like us to do in addition, and anything that we can better help you, we would like to do. So thank you all, and good night.